Welcome to ID the Future, a podcast about intelligent design and evolution.
This is Michael Medved, and on my radio show, I'm generally concerned with what is timely, but every once in a while, we get to focus on the timeless. And when you're talking about the timeless, I immediately think of our trips to Israel. We've taken more than a dozen trips to Israel with listeners, with interested parties, many people who are going to Israel for the first time. And for the first time in 4 years, we're doing it again with Discovery Institute. Check out this remarkable opportunity, the Israel Tour at discovery.org/Israel2019. It's going to be happening in the fall of 2019, late summer, early fall. And we're going to be going with George Gilder about technology, with Stephen Meyer about science, and myself on the history and country and culture of Israel. This is going to be a remarkable experience. Please join us.
Welcome to ID the Future, a podcast about evolution and intelligent design. I'm your host today, Mike Keyes, and I'm pleased to have back with me J.P. Moreland, Distinguished Professor of Philosophy at Biola University, and author of many books and countless journal articles in some of the leading journals of the field of philosophy. His latest book, Scientism and Secularism, is the one that we're focusing on today. I mentioned at the end of the last podcast that many of our listeners who aren't particularly religious are still very interested in how this book on scientism might connect with the discussion about Darwinism and intelligent design. So let me suggest this as a point of departure. In your book, you do deal a little bit with the debate over contemporary versions of Darwin's theory, and many of these Darwinists, of course, champion scientism, the main topic of your book. Now, what I'd like you to talk with me about is how might a prior commitment to scientism on the part of a scientist precondition that scientist to be less open to considering the evidence for intelligent design? And let me ask you to specifically address one example, the topic of bad design, that bad design implicates no design. Are these people that are making these bad design arguments, are they in a sort of backdoor sort of way appealing to theology in making a Darwinist argument against design? And if so, how does your book on scientism connect with this strategy of using theology in a naturalistic argument against design? How's that go?
Well, you're absolutely right. And it's ironic, isn't it, that this is happening. One of the ways that scientism would affect a scientist is that scientism, since the 1920s, has been what justifies materialism or physicalism. That's basically the idea that the only thing that exists is matter and energy and the physical. And so consciousness is nothing but neuronic firings in the brain. And there is no self. You are either your brain or your body or some material object. And so the result of scientism has been the philosophical limitation of explanations in science to only those that are material or physical explanations. So, for example, we have to explain why your arm moves by appealing only to nervous system and brain events. It's not legitimate to appeal also to the intentional free choice of an agent to raise his arm.
Right.
That would be to step outside of science, and because science is now committed to only material explanations. There's another word for that, and that's called methodological naturalism. That in doing science, we only can accept naturalistic explanations for data. And by the way, naturalistic explanations are purely physical or material explanations, because remember, scientism certifies only the statements about reality that come from physics, chemistry, biology, and neuroscience. And all those allegedly are making and only making physical knowledge claims about the truth of reality, not non-physical knowledge claims. And so this scientism ultimately puts a straitjacket on science by requiring science to only limit itself to physicalist and naturalistic explanations. Now, the odd thing is that the kind of arguments that you're citing, which, by the way, and you would know this more than I do, but I mentioned this in the book, these kinds of explanations were not just rhetorical shots at theology. They were actually arguments that were used to justify a Darwinian explanation. And the arguments went like this. Look, if there was a designer, he would have done a much more efficient job of designing this body part than the body part is designed. It's dysfunctional in a lot of ways. And so the dysfunctionality of this body part shows that there could not have been an intelligent designer because it would have looked otherwise.
Right.
So that is actually showing that science can, in fact, falsify a model of God as designer. The problem is, what is sauce for the falsifying goose ought to be sauce for the verifying gander. And if science can falsify a theological model of God as designer, I don't see why it cannot also provide some supportive warrant or justification for an intelligent designer model as an explanatory model, and that would be incorporated within science by virtue of their very practice of using scientific data to falsify an intelligent design scientific model that they say failed.
Yeah, so we've got a case here where we're catching proponents of scientism sneaking in the back door certain actually theological assumptions that have a substantive part in the arguments they're making. And so this is, I see that you're doing two things with this. You're, on the one hand, you're using this to critique scientism. It's like, look, guys, look at your own practice. And by the way, your own practice, although these are theological arguments, they may not be very good ones at that.
Yes.
Maybe, you know, because, like, for example, a body part that's maybe not optimal in the view of the scientists, well, maybe there's a larger ecological context in which an organism shouldn't have too much capability in this area because it might wreak ecological havoc. You know, there might be good design reasons for this.
Absolutely. Michael, I'd like to broach a subject here as we have time.
Sure.
And I developed this in Scientism and Secularism, but I want your audience to really hear about this, and it'll whet their appetite to study this in the book. Mm-hmm. I list criteria for when it is rational to go against the overwhelming majority of experts in a field, because often it's not. For example, if I've had cancer and I've gone through all kinds of surgeries and so on, and when I talked to my oncologist, she said that, you know, 98% of oncologists say that therapy X is better for my kind of cancer than therapy Y. Well, I'm going to go with the majority of experts in a field. I'm not an expert, all things being equal. But I don't do that when it comes to those biological Darwinist explanations that come from paleontology and biology, even though the overwhelming number of experts in those fields accept those explanations. Now, why do I accept the majority in the case of medicine, but not in Darwinism? Am I just doing that because I don't want my theology to be falsified? Or am I being rational? And in the book, I say I am being rational in those different approaches because there are a set of criteria which, if met, makes it rationally justifiable to go against the majority of experts in a field. And criterion number one is if the homogeneity among the experts can be explained by sociological and theological reasons rather than by the rationality of their shared paradigm in explaining the facts, then I don't have to respect their agreement because it is not based on the rationality of the what they share in common, but it's based on sociology and theology. Now, I show in the book that the primary reason Darwinism won, according to some of the experts in the history of science who are not Christian theists but know that area, was not because of the facts, but because Darwinism got theology out of science and God concepts out of science and made biology a purely natural science like chemistry and physics.
At least the perception of that, even though often it gets sneaked in the back door, right?
Exactly. You're absolutely right by the perception of that. And then there are sociological reasons because there are rewards and punishments if you don't go with the methodological naturalist Darwinist paradigm. You'll be ostracized. I know a guy who had a dissertation ID proposal at UCLA in microbiology that was empirically testable, and he was told that he would simply not get passed if he did this, and he had to come up with a different dissertation topic. Well, it's no wonder that ID theories don't get tested in regular research labs because of the sociology. The second criterion is that if your minority view has the backing of a small but highly qualified group of intellectual scholars that support this, then like Thomas Kuhn pointed out in Structure of Scientific Revolutions, this small group can be considered a rebel group that has the intellectual chutzpah, you might say, to be believed even though they go against the majority paradigm because these people are not accepting the indoctrination that is given in the socialization of most scientists. And why their presence matters is that they are a group of highly qualified scientists and philosophers of science and historians of science who have earned PhDs in all the major universities, just like the Darwinists. They publish in good publishing houses, and their arguments are rigorous and highly credible. Well, we have that today. And so these two criteria, I mentioned some others, but these two criteria, if they're present, justify the rationality of accepting this minority view rather than accepting the majority view among the experts. And I think that's what we've got going on with ID, and that's why I believe it's rational to reject Darwinism for ID theory, even if the majority of scientists in these fields and philosophers of science accept Darwinism.
Indeed, and Kepler and Galileo, they had to fight against the majority viewpoint of their day, and they eventually won.
Absolutely.
So, hey, let's do one more conversation. We're out of time right now. So thanks, JP, for joining us today with your book topic, Scientism and Secularism. So thanks for joining us.
Good to be with you.
This is Mike Keyes with ID the Future, and thank you, our audience, for joining us. Come back for one more episode on JP's book.
This program was recorded by Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. ID the Future is copyright Discovery Institute. For more information, visit intelligentdesign.org and idthefuture.com.